Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. On today's episode, we sit down with Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and visual storyteller Vincent LaFerre. Vincent was at the forefront of the film industry's digital revolution back in 2011. We'll ask him how things have changed since then. Vincent is also the new owner of Red's hot new camera, the Komodo 6K, and we'll get his take on this new toy. So settle in, and we'll be right back with our guest, Vincent LaFerre. So, Vincent, welcome to today's show. I really appreciate you doing this. Good to see you, man.
Same here. It's great to see you, too.
It's been too long. It's been way too long.
Always.
So, yeah, it really is. All right, so you and I have a fairly long relationship, and we understand where we came from. But people who are listening don't. And the show is called Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? So we're going to start a little bit at the beginning.
Okay.
I've heard you speak two or three different languages. So let's start with, where the hell are you from?
Both of my parents are French. I was born actually in Switzerland. My mother thought it was a wise thing to go skiing when she was 8 months pregnant. So I ended up being born in Switzerland a little bit early. And took a helicopter flight when I was a preemie, which may have influenced my future life. Who knows? One can dream. To a hospital for preemies. I wasn't supposed to survive, but I made it. And then, in fact, they didn't show me to my mom for quite a while. But I made it. I spent the first 5 years of my life in France growing up. And then my mom eventually moved to New York City and remarried. My dad stayed in France. And he was a photographer as well. He worked for Gamma and Premiere Magazine as a director of photography. Moved to the U.S. Again, obviously, I only knew one word of English, which was sheriff, because it's the same word in English and French. And grew up in New York City. I've studied several languages, you know, Spanish, Russian, French. Kind of an international kid. When I would go back and forth from the age of 5 to 18, I would go, you know, summer camp in France and hear all the French people make fun of Americans and kind of be a chameleon and vice versa. And that taught me how to just be part of any type of conversation as a chameleon to some degree. And understanding also how human beings, you know, have more of this clan mentality of us versus them, and how much at the end of the day we're all very similar and have very similar interests. And I think that really helped me as a photojournalist, you know, when I eventually did that.
All right. So obviously there was an interest in imaging from early on, like you said, your dad. When did it sort of bite you? You've got like, although I didn't realize this from all the years we've known each other, you're really well educated. I mean, it doesn't stick out too much, but you're there.
I understood
Northwestern. You also went to
Scholar. You know, I didn't go to Oxford or anything, but I did get a benefit from a pretty fantastic education, thanks to my mother, in large part. You know, whether it was high school or a college, I value that a lot. Obviously, it was a huge privilege. I was an artistic kid early on. You know, I think the divorce stuff was pretty hard on me, and I found refuge in art. I was a musician. I played saxophone. I was a tenor soloist in the choir. I was an oil painter. I was a life drawer, a sculptor, all that fun stuff that, you know, we all go through. Again, to your point, when you get a good education, when you have that benefit of the arts programs that, you know, maybe my kids don't have right now in public school in LA. So I don't want to take that for granted, how important that was foundationally for me. But I learned some really fantastic art teachers, you know, in a variety of arts, so that when I was 15, I literally said to myself, it's silly, I use the word stupid, that I don't know how to take a picture when my father's a professional photographer. And I said to him, can you teach me the basics? And he said, sure. He handed me a Nikon F3 with a 50 millimeter and had a roll of Tri-X in there. And to say it was instantaneous is an understatement. I'm getting goosebumps now just talking about it, because that's how visceral it was. You know, I could not wait for that oil painting or, you know, acrylic to dry fast enough. I was also, by the way, I forgot about this, which is relevant, doing a lot of stuff in computers. I was I had an Amiga 500, and I was ray tracing at the age of like 13, 14, 15. And I was also scanning photographs with a RGB wheel on a black and white camera. So I had a computer side of my brain, and I had this creative side. And when the still camera came into my life, it was pretty instantaneous. Like, that's it. This is what I want to do. No question.
This is high schoolish.
This is high school. This is, so 15 years old, right? I would assume is like a sophomore-ish, freshman, sophomore.
And you went to Dalton.
I went to Dalton,
which is a really huge school.
Yeah, it's a pretty fancy school. Like, you know, like I said, my mom had the wherewithal to put me to the Lycée Français as a French kid,
right,
in New York eventually. And then for high school, I went to Dalton, which is this very, you know, incredible high school that pretty much is, when I went to college, it was easy compared to, you know, Dalton, you know, and they had fantastic resources, you know, accesses to the first Macs, and,
right,
you know, they were teaching us how to code at that age. And I was using Macromedia Director to animate stuff for my science class. You get the idea. It was a huge privilege, and it definitely benefited me incredibly well.
Some crazy alumni out of there. I mean, a lot of,
yeah,
a lot of celebrity, a lot of...
Sean Lennon was in my class, for example, right? And a lot of different people. So the who's who of New York would send their kids there, you know, and I was very lucky to get in, and I was extremely fortuitous to get a scholarship there, because my mother got divorced in that period and went, you know, from having a normal income to no income at all. And the headmaster at the time found someone to basically give me a scholarship, which is, I'm hugely, you know, appreciative of, to say the least.
So who was the headmaster at the time?
Gardner Dunnan, I believe, was his name. He saw my photography skills, I guess, and my background. And when he found out that obviously my mother had just gotten divorced and couldn't afford it anymore, he took it upon himself to say, let's keep this kid in here and find a benefactor to this day, I don't know who that is. I can't find out. Just pay for my way through Dalton.
That headmaster, you know who he replaced?
Yes, I do.
Bill Barr's dad.
Yes.
Attorney General's dad, yeah.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And don't forget, Jeffrey Epstein taught there till 1975. So it's a very diverse school.
It's a crazy school with crazy backgrounds, yes. But, I guess that happens when you mix in, you know, all the powerhouse people and artists send their kids there, right?
No, I think getting thrown into a crazy environment that at a young age, mm-hmm, prepares you for the crazy environment that we live in at this age.
I've never thought about it that way till you mentioned it, but truth be told, you're absolutely right. You know, I was exposed to a lot of interesting things at Dalton. You know, I had kids who would go out to their big country houses on the weekend and shoot their Uzis in their forests.
Right.
Right. You know, and do worse things. You know, it was like, here I was coming from this, you know, Lycée Français, which is, you know, blazer, gray pants, very proper, very, you know, almost socialist system, you know, French educational system,
right,
where you don't talk back to this world. And yeah, it opened my eyes. All right.
Yeah. I went to a private Jesuit school, mm-hmm, which was the school they made the movie about.
Yes.
They got the Academy Award. So yeah, we've got that going on too. So they're interesting. You know, I don't want to redo everything in my life, but being exposed at that age to all kinds of life, I think, makes a huge difference. I've always done it with my kids. You'll do it with yours.
That's what I tell every photographer, cinematographer, director, artist, wannabe, young person, is I say, listen, the reason I can go around and talk to the likes of, let's just say, randomly a Tim Cook or a CEO of any company, is rarely based on photography. Sometimes they'll talk to me because they want to find out the photography. But more often than not, the hook that I get into them is talking about something completely different, some sort of artistic or creative, or, you know, a musician, a band, a play, a TV show that we both watched and we find some similarity on, or some similar interest. And to your point, I think that's why it's so important to get a good, well-rounded education.
Yep.
You know, I definitely got that at Northwestern, which is my next stop.
Yep.
I went to the Medill School of Journalism there. But what I remember from Medill is a few things, but I really remember studying Nietzsche, or studying, you know, cognitive science, how the brain works and the occipital lobe and the rods and the cones in your eye and stuff like that. And I cannot tell you how often my conversations, including a series we'll probably talk about at some point here, literally came out of that, you know, cognitive science class in college that explained how the brain saw and explained brain synapses, et cetera, which is a pre-med class. And that's what informed, you know, 15 years later, a project, you know, an aerial project and a conversation. So to your point, like, mm-hmm, that foundation is critical.
So years later, we'll move up a little bit. Let's go to 2002. 2002 okay. was a really big year for you.
Sure.
You are 27 years old, I think. Okay. 28, maybe?
Sounds about right. 27, sounds about right, yeah.
You were picked as one of the 30 photographers under 30.
Mm-hmm.
And you won a Pulitzer.
Sure.
So that's kind of one of those years when you think, did I peak too early? You know, I mean, 27. Yeah. But, you know, it's good and it's, well, I mean, William Pulitzer is good. Sure. Being 30 under 30 is good until you're 31. So, although what, PDN, I think you put you in the top 100 a little later. So, right. For, you know, 100 under 100.
You've done your research, too.
So, yeah, actually, you know, it's strange looking up old friends when you actually have these shows and you go, I had no idea. How many times have we had dinner and it never came up? So what was 2002 like?
Well, it's funny.
And I don't think I've ever asked you how you got or how somebody gets a Pulitzer. I just knew you had one.
That's what I was going to try to address, which is when you mentioned 2002 was a big year for you, I don't remember any of that stuff. I remember 2001 vividly because that changed my life, you know. And I guess that's going to speak to the answer, which is when I went through 9/11, that was, like Katrina was, a foundational event in my life and obviously the country's life or experience or history, where I was in France with my dad and 9/11 happened. I couldn't get back into the States, so they sent me to Pakistan and with the goal of going into Afghanistan. And I was a 26 or so year old kid who'd shot World Series, Super Bowls, I think an Olympics by then? Yeah, no, not yet. And had traveled as a person, but I was not a war correspondent by any stretch of the imagination. When bullets fly, I hit the deck and I stay down because they don't care what your ideology is. They don't have any reasoning. They hit whatever's in their way. But for 3 months, I was stationed right on the edge of Kandahar, which was the center of ISIS or the Taliban, sorry. And I was documenting what was in front of me, and I teamed up with another photographer named Patrick Aventurier, who was at Gamma, who I'd met with my dad when I was a teenager. And he was a seasoned veteran in wars, but didn't have that many resources, whereas I was a newbie who worked for the New York Times and had a driver and a fixer. And so we teamed up and he saved my life and I saved his life on a few occasions. But those were transformational experiences. I eventually put out with the New York Times a slideshow about what was going on over there. And to me, that was the first time as a journalist that I felt I was making a contribution to the overall discussion, where I had World War II veterans say things like, thank you for showing us that all these people aren't terrorists, you know, and people from all walks of life. And it was like, okay, that's what journalism is. You know, you're doing a public service. You are sharing information with people on the ground, firsthand, to your best of your ability to be objective, to really show that at that time in Pakistan, all you had for the most part were 99.9% of people that were just as terrified as we were back in the States of being bombed, and the 0.1% that was, you know, crazy Taliban type people saying kill America, kill Bush.
But yeah. How many years did you spend as a war correspondent?
I don't say that I ever did. You know, I spent 3 months there, and then I went on an aircraft carrier in 2003 for a month as an embed, which is probably the safest place on earth to be in the middle of a carrier strike group. So, I went for training with former SAS guys, you know, that they put journalists through, where they kidnap you and they teach you how to find landmines with a barbecue stick, and they teach you how to put your entrails back in if you blow up, you get blown up, and where to hide from bullets and from mobs and mob mentality and how, you know, you get kidnapped, all that fun stuff. So I did the training. I am not, and I will never call myself or dignify anything that I did as a war correspondent. Okay. People who do that and merit that, and that is not me.
Though, I mean, we know those people. You know more of them than I do. I mean, the James Notchways of the world and so on. There's an adrenaline junkie type personality to those people that never struck me as you.
I actually met Nakwe right there in that hotel in Islamabad and was floored when he said, are you Vincent LaFerre?
Oh my God.
Like, what? He's like, I'm like, how the hell do you know who I am? And, you know, we're literally halfway across the globe. And he looks at me and says, are you Vincent LaFerre? I'm like, what do you mean? You're James Nakwe, the god of all gods.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, I read your credit every day in the New York Times. Of course I know who you are. I'm like, and then we made friends because he had the prototype 1D. And he hated it. He loathed going digital, as you can imagine, because he'd been shooting Chrome. And he was like, this is the most horrible body. And it turned out the body was like 30 points green or something. But he was shooting RAW. And I'm like, here's how you correct it. And we made friends over that. And me helping him with a sat phone. But that was like one of those things. Yeah.
You know, I spent a week with him in a weird place. It was up in Mendocino at another photographer, Greg Gorman.
Greg is
not a war photographer. That don't get. No. I mean, for the people that don't know, for the people that know him, I don't have to explain. For the people who don't, I can't explain. But it was this Apple thing we were doing. Apple was coming out with iMovie, and we had these photographers, and I was teaching them how to use cameras, and they were going to do stories, motion stories. And they assigned me James to do a story with. And I thought that was one of the most intimidating 20 minutes. And then it got easy because all I realized is as long as I don't – we went out on a boat.
Yeah.
He found a fisherman, decided to do a day in the life of a fisherman. And as long as I didn't knock him over the side, we were going to be fine. And there was nothing I needed to teach him. Nothing. No. And I have found that in my years of – of switching or working with still photographers as they make that transition to motion, there's a different kind of storytelling. There's the still photographers that can take one great image at a time and tell a story with an image, and then there's the ones that don't seem to make that jump to telling it with 24 frames a second. Some transition really well, some never do. There's just sort of that thing. It was just natural for him. I don't think he even liked doing it, to be honest, but he did it, and he did it really well.
And I could tell you that I would have guessed, you know, that that would be the case because of all the photographers out there at the time and to this day, but especially at the time, what differentiated his work besides the incredible quality of his photography was his ability to tell a story with multiple images and weave them together. And that is a very difficult art. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I ever ascended to that level of competency as a still photographer, even after, so from 15 to like whenever the 5D came out, was it 2008? So
2008.
So that would be what, 33 or something, right? So I did this for, sorry, my math is poor. So 75 is 25 years, and then another 8 years. So 34 years, is that right? Am I okay? No, 24 years, right? Whatever, my math is terrible. But I did. My point is I did photography for a long time. I don't think I ever got to the level where I was happy with creating a wonderful image sequence. It's a very lost art. So to hear that he went from what he did, which is a master of that, into motion effortlessly makes total sense.
And then right back to stills again, because I don't think you had that much interest in it. He did it just fine, and it just didn't appeal to him. I think he saw it as not enough of a challenge. The challenge, you know, of telling a story with a couple of frames versus letting it roll, and it's a different storytelling. And
they're both difficult for sure. You're absolutely right. But you know what? It reminds me of a conversation I had with Roger Deakins at one point, where I was very excited about the 5D Mark II, and I asked him what he would do, and he was like, "I rather like what I do very much." You know, meaning I do what I do, I'm happy. Yeah. And he and I became, you know, friendly after that exchange, which terrified me initially, but. You know, because he realized I had a documentary background, which was where he became from. But initially, he was very defensive about that because every producer in Hollywood was trying to push him towards the Alexa and digital, let alone 5D. So he again gave me a canned response, I think, that one time when I went up to him. But I can see Nakwe saying the same thing. Like, he does his thing very well. He doesn't need to do motion. And what differentiates Nakwe is that he would not stay up and drink or do anything crazy. He would wake up at 5, meditate, have a fruit smoothie, and smoke every single photographer before they even woke up. And he would be coming back in after all the good light was gone when we were going out at 10 or 11 to go shoot.
All right, so I'm not going to stay on Nakwe too long because he's not the guest. But for those of you who have been listening and want to get know more about him, watch the Bang Bang Club. There's a movie, there's a doc, there's also a movie, and he's part of that. And that will give you, that is the most realistic, that's what war journalists do. And that's why I could
There's also a documentary on him as well, where they put a camera on his own camera.
Right.
That was cool. fantastic.
Right. And but there's also a dramatization about it, which
which
is emotionally right, but technically wrong. So anyway, so if you're interested in watching that one. So let's get to 2008, because that was an enormous year in your life. First off, you met me in 2008. I became a Facebook friend of yours. 2008 was a turning point in my life, and it turned at the same time yours was sort of turning as well. Because there was this new camera that everybody should aware.
We should go to 2002, because we never addressed that real quick.
Okay, yeah, do too.
Just your point, because it informs 2008. I and five other photographers, I think it was, maybe it was four, and I was the fifth, were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for 9/11 coverage, right? I didn't even know I had been nominated. So the way I found out I won a Pulitzer with the others was I got a call from Earl, the Pearl Wilson, our photo desk person, at like 11 a.m. nonchalantly during my shift, saying, "You might want to come into the office." I'm like, "For what?" He's like, "The Pulitzer Prize, you know, awards are being awarded today." And I'm like, "So?" He's like, "Well, you know you were nominated, right?" I'm like, "No." And literally, I didn't know. I didn't care. And we found out that we had won as a team. And the paper actually won both awards that year. Feature News, which was what my team won, and also Breaking News, which was the New York photographers won. So it's a huge deal for the paper. To your point, 2002, the reason I don't remember it is I don't really remember the 30 on the 30 now or the 100 photographers or even the Pulitzer, other than when I was chosen to go, you know, pick up the hardware, if you will, the ceremony. I went downstairs at the Columbia School of Journalism and I threw up because you'd mentioned too early, right?
Yeah.
There were two things going on. One was no one has ever won a Pulitzer. You asked like how it feels for a good event. It's just as much the gravity of the event and what happened. Yeah. And I think you win a Pulitzer for showing up that day and doing your job, right? And maybe excelling a little bit. But mostly, it's completely correlated with the event. So you might do an incredible job on a non-event. You'll never win a Pulitzer for that, more than likely. But if you do a good job on one of the biggest news stories of the year, that's how you might get an award. But getting that at 2002, right? So 27 was very odd because, you know, it's a very rare award for photographers. There aren't many of us, right? It's not like the Emmys, which are much more prolific. And so that made me sick, along with the entire association of such a horrific event with an award, you know? And then to your point about like, hey, I'm only 27, what are you next, right? Especially in that field, that was the Oscar in photography. There was no higher award. There are different awards for sure, like World Press, yada, yada, the Robert Capra Award. But
that's the thing that becomes part of your title. It's part of your, it's kind of like when you get the Academy Award, then that person Oscar is always winning. Oscar winning so-and-so, and it's Pulitzer winning. I mean, I think that's how you were introduced to me. And it was sort of completely irrelevant to what you and I were going to do in 2008, but it becomes your title. You've been knighted.
So at 27. It's our first knighting in the U.S., and it's very odd. You know, it's an odd feeling, especially at 27. So the reason I brought it, went back in time, is I progressed from that. So saying, you know, Katrina kind of did me in terms of the craziness, you know, what I witnessed as a photojournalist. And mentally, it broke me down a little bit. And then eventually, sorry, we have the leaf blowers here.
That's okay.
If you can hear that. Okay.
Well, so Katrina, welcome to 2020.
Welcome to 2020. That did me in. I think that ended my photojournalism career was Katrina. It was just, you know, we always had a rule that whatever happens overseas, happens overseas. But when you saw that same type of stuff happen here, it broke down a lot of war photojournalists that you might recognize who couldn't deal with it being at home. And then I was like, well, what's next? You know, and I didn't know what to do. I wanted to experiment more. And that's why I asked to leave the staff of the New York Times and become a contractor. Moby actually reached out to me, which connects with 2008. To photograph his concert, and I had to say no because I was a staffer at the New York Times, and the contract would have allowed me to do that. And that led me to 2008, when the real story behind the entire experience is that I was actually going into Cannes, and I haven't told many people this, to drop out of the program. Did you ever know that?
On what, in 2008?
When the 5D Mark II thing happened?
I remember you getting your hands on the first or the second first 5D Mark II before I got my hands on it. And that's when I said, who's Vincent? So,
and why does he have it? the ultimate irony of that, just to share with people how your life can take a turn so quickly and randomly, is I was supposed to see a guy named David Sparer for lunch, and he blew me off, as you know David often did, and said, you know, well, why don't you come back next week, pick Thursday or Friday? And I was kind of miffed, because you know it was an important meeting for me, and I said, well, okay, Friday. And the irony is, I was coming in to drop out of the Explorer of Light program because one of the cameras at Canon had some autofocus issues, and I was like, I can't be associated.
That's right. Okay, so for the listeners, Canon has a program called Explorers of Light. They would recruit, still do. No, it's not what it used to be, but still do recruit the cream of the crop of still photographers, and get them to support Canon products in the field. It's an elite position. It is something that photographers love to be part of. Maybe not as much as before, but back then for sure, when it was Canon and Nikon were the two players. So you were either a Nikon shooter or a Canon shooter, and if you were a Canon Explorer, you were considered the cream of the crop. So, yes, and nobody quit it. So that's what this makes.
No one ever said,
I'm done with this.
Right, and I'm a little bit of a Boy Scout in terms of ethics and morals because of the New York Times. And I just said, I cannot represent a brand that has a clear problem with their autofocus and isn't addressing it. And it had been over a year, and I had just come back from the Olympics in Beijing. And I had sat with a colleague of mine with the exact same camera, exact same lens, exact same settings. All of my pictures were in focus. All of his pictures were out of focus. And the irony of ironies is I was coming in to drop out of the program. And luckily, David blew me off when I did. And I didn't choose to come in on a Thursday, but instead I chose a Friday, because literally, as in the movies, like a Scorsese scene where you're following, you know, into Copacabana, as I was walking in, this white box that motivated the camera to the next scene literally brushed past me, and I followed it like a puppy dog, because I knew exactly that what that was. And those white boxes were the prototype boxes.
Right.
And I just kind of stood there at the table and said, what's that? You know, like kind of the geek, like, what's that? Knowing full well something I wasn't supposed to see. And that led to the whole 5D Mark II thing, which, instead of ending my relationship with Canon, let it go into a whole other direction for many, many more years.
So David made the correct decision. Got to give him props for that. And he put the camera into your hands in 2002.
After 4 hours of my badgering him to do so, just so you know.
And
badgering is a fair thing.
I think the way he tells it is, you know, he had to convince you one or the other. But
it was
this brilliant move by both of you to put this camera into your hands. And you took it out and shot a film, shot a demo, shot a, I don't know what we want to call that, but it was revolutionary.
It's a bad cologne commercial.
Yes, that's true. It was.
And what it was, I mean, I like accuracy in the history. And I'm the only one talking, so let the victors write history here. I had to badger Canon for 4 hours to get that body. So what happened was they let me reluctantly take it out of the box,
right,
put 2470 on it, and I walked around Canon HQ, which is cubicles, but it looked like a motion picture. And it's like the light bulb went on, it burst. Mm-hmm. And I said, holy shit.
Yeah, it's a podcast.
This is going to change everything. I knew it instantly. I still got goosebumps. I told the story. And then I said, Dave, you got to let me do something with this. He's like, hey, sorry, man. You did the last camera we launched, which is like a D60 or something. It's not your turn, which is very fair, right? There are many explorers. I didn't let go. I went all the way through to lunch with him, badgering till he said yes. And he finally said, all right, already. You know, I think it was, I'm blanking on his name, or a friend from Atlanta, not Dennis.
Dave Carlson?
No, a photographer who didn't get it, who eventually got it. Anyways, I'm disastrous with names, but he knows. We make fun of it all the time. He said, listen, this guy's not going to be back from his assignment until Wednesday. Take it over the weekend. Shoot something if you feel like it. Just write me an email on Monday. That was the 5D Mark II, and I took it out with three friends. I had been around cinema with my dad. I knew enough to know I didn't have a steady camera or dolly. I didn't even have a tripod except for one moment. And I shot a very bad cologne commercial that ended up being, I think, a very genuine product video, right? A marketing video, inadvertently. And it changed my life. It changed a lot of other lives because of this technology being out there. And that was a big deal. So if you ever get an opportunity, guys, and you got to badger someone for 4 hours, do it. and then make the best of it.
Look, that film was called Reverie, and it changed my life because I wasn't in that division. I spent my life on the motion side at Canon, and Canon came out with this camera on the still side and gave it to a still photographer who made a motion movie out of it. And all of a sudden, it's like now the world, everything was upside down. And, you know, I saw Reverie for the first time. It had already been graded, colored, popped up on a server, which we crashed.
That was the key, by the way. It was raw footage. Never initially was graded at all. And it crashed every server because no one was used to doing that.
We had no idea how many people were going to watch this thing.
Right.
And it crashed it, but it looked spectacular. And it was lighting. It was a lot of you making the image, and it was shallow depth of field. There's only two things involved in it. Your ability to create a beautiful image and the cinematic quality of a large sensor.
That's it.
That's really all that camera had going for it, but it was dramatic. It was a big sensor.
And glass, access to like six, seven primes that the average cinematographer, you know, would be on a Zoom or might not have the budget to do this. So the sensitivity to low light was huge too. I remember showing it to ASC members and have them literally say, well, how did you light the Brooklyn Bridge?
Right.
Because that's how they had to do it at the time. And I'm like, I didn't. It's just recorded it. And they're like, what? So it was the low light sensitivity, the size of the sensor and the lenses. It was an incredible camera.
It's the only time the term game changer has ever been fairly used. I hate that term.
I try never
to use it. I think it's incredibly overused, but it did change things. It changed things over at Red, which went on to become a spectacular company, but all of a sudden a challenger appeared in this weird world. It was all of a sudden there was this camera that people will compare it to the Red, compare it to the Aerie.
Versus, you know, close to 100.
Yeah, I mean, it was a whole different thing. Then all of a sudden, everybody wanted to say we just democratized Hollywood. And a lot of good stuff came out of it. There was some great movies made with that. I always felt shooting a film with a 5D was more of a privilege than a right, you know, and it shouldn't be overused because at some point it was 6,000 movies with shallow depth of field and everybody pulling focus from your eyeball to your nose, you know, for dramatic effect. Shane Hurlbut did Act of Valor, which was a spectacular kind of, not a one-off film necessarily, but a unique take on a submarine film, incredibly unique on these little cameras. Yep. I got involved with 24. Mm-hmm. Well, 24, they did use it as well. But I'm talking about Gail Tattersall, House.
Yes, House.
When we did an episode of House on those.
You know, the first network broadcast show.
Series, and it was a cliffhanger, and they put away their expensive cameras and shot the whole thing on, which I'd said to Gail at the time, I think this is crazy and you shouldn't do it, because I just didn't think it would work, and he made it work. He made it work. The one thing I think that people overlook on that camera is what made it work was how bad the compression was. I think that the QuickTime compression in it hit a lot of sins and gave it a bit of a grainy look that people liked.
Yeah.
But it was poor compression that did it, not good compression. There was a certain amount of, if it had been a pristine image, it wouldn't have been as good an image.
You would have seen the flaws more clearly. And the compression, I'm looking at the Skype video right now, which has horrible compression. Yeah, I have a little bit of PTSD with it for sure.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, it's like,
yeah, but it worked. I know. On the thing we did with Gail on House, the episode was about House and a victim being trapped in this collapsed building, lots of smoke everywhere, and because of the collapsed building, the actors would then use flashlights essentially to light themselves. So there's a lot of flashlights going on, which caused all these banding issues, which disappeared in all of the compression problems. So, you know, just more smoke, but made it work.
It was just one of those tools that came out at the right place at the right time with the right flaws. I know it's a big deal and I think a legitimate game changer because I still have people every month or so walk up to me or tell me, by the way, that video changed the course of my career.
Yep.
Right? And quite a few. So I know that camera really changed a lot of lives out there because it did effectively start to democratize film for good and for bad. Opened up a lot of possibilities for a lot of people and changed a lot of things.
It was that one time where people didn't realize high quality still cameras could shoot video. And all of a sudden it was going to places that we can't do it anymore.
Right.
But even when Mitt Romney made his private speech that said, you know, 27% of you will never vote for me anyway, whatever it was, which was sort of a game changer in his election. Mm-hmm. He made that in front of a 5D because you weren't allowed to shoot video in there, but you could shoot stills.
Right.
And security people didn't know it shot motion and got this video recording that went viral and maybe even changed the course of an election. So those days are gone. Now everybody's got iPhones. There's video everywhere. That's all there is to it. But it was a fun time. All right. So let's jump to the next phase. So now we've known each other now from 2008. We're getting up to C300. So it's like 3-4 years.
Okay. Maybe was it you that told me that I was the best thing to happen to Canon and the worst thing? Was that you? You had a quote at the time about me.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, because it, yes, I think I probably, sounds like something I would have said. And I, with all love, I swear. But yeah, it was you truly upset the apple cart. Because that feature was never designed to do what I believed it could do and you believed it could do.
That's why I bring it up, because for people listening in on this that will experience something hopefully similar or a variant of it in their careers, it was generally not well received within Canon. I got a lot of resistance, and I was seen as this pain in the ass for starting this trend by a lot of people because they were caught completely unprepared. Mm-hmm. The inclusion of video in the 5D Mark II by many of them was the equivalent of adding it into a point-and-shoot camera as a feature, like the Elf back then. Literally like, oh, by the way, it shoots video. That's the way they thought of it. They had no idea this was coming. And I think it's fair to say it changed, to some degree, the structure of Canon and where their priorities lay at, to some degree, right? You know, as a result of one video.
To an intense degree. I mean, I went through it. I remember literally being told exactly what you just said. I was told by a gentleman to calm down. It's not going to be what you think it is. And I was like, it's more than what I think it is. You don't seem to understand what this is going to do. I remember being invited to a training by the camera division because I was the video guy and there was a video function. So I'm the only video person there. Everybody else is the still side.
Right.
And it's 2 days of printer training and 2 days of this and then one day on the new camera. And then as we're waiting for our cabs to come to take us back to the airport, one of the Canon executives says, we shot this video clip in the room last night and we're just going to play it because it also does video. And it was a video of him pulling focus from a Coke can to the phone and back. And he said, so it does have the video function. We think it's a QuickTime file, but we don't know much about it. And I was like, okay, everybody stand still here. Nobody gets on the plane. Nobody goes anywhere. Did you just see what that was?
Really?
And
did you actually stop people?
They wouldn't. No, they wouldn't. They just, at this point, it's like, oh, it shoots video. You know, Tim, he's a video guy.
Yeah, no one got it, guys. I mean, and ladies and whoever's listening, that this is what's important is people often are shown technology or new things, and they either don't take the time to think about where that might lead us or how revolutionary it is. The vast majority of people just don't see it. You know, that's something I love to do, is to see new technology and see immediately this could be applied here, 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 and here, and potentially change things. And that's what happened with the 5D Mark II. I was like, this will change everything if it is what I think it is. And that's why I fought for 4 hours to borrow it. But what I remember from those years was a tremendous amount of like angst, because half the people at Canon, whatever percentage it was, really liked what I had done. The other half hated me to no fault of my own for shaking the tree. Like the PR people hated the fact that this one young person borrowed a camera for a weekend with no budget. I think I had $2,500 that would pay for the helicopter hour. No budget, no plan, no brief, nothing, no marketing tips. Shot a behind-the-scenes video haphazardly because it was kind of fun with friends, put it out, and frankly embarrassed a lot of them because I got results that no one else had ever gotten, in large part due to the technology, by the way. You know, and that made a lot of people bitter for years. Anyways,
some of them who said this is never going to work, the next day said, see, I told you it's going to work. I mean, it was just that, you know, oh, we crashed a server. I could have saw that coming. There was that weird kind of thing where you just step back. And I think the people on the video side, myself, a guy named Joe Bogaz and Mike Zorch, some of the older school ones, we immediately said, you know, people have been telling us in all our meetings, bigger sensor, bigger sensor. Video division was making them smaller and smaller, saying, look, the smaller we make the sensor, the stronger the zooms can be. And we're like,
Yeah.
And I'm out there with an XL1, which was a really good camera with a 3rd inch sensor. And yeah. there's companies out there making 12-pound widgets to put on the front just to yes. get shallow depth of field.
Exactly.
Because we're not making a big sensor. And then all right. of a sudden the 5D comes out. I really thought, you know, when it came out, actually, I knew Jim Gennard over at Red from other things for over the years because mm-hmm. he was a big Canon shooter, and we knew what he was doing, and Red was starting to hit. And my first mm-hmm. thought was, I need a job at Red because mm-hmm. this is going to put Canon's video division out of business. And I'm mm-hmm. in the video division. And it, right. at some point then, we had some new management come in. They had insight and forethought and some right. vision. And then we created this pro group, and they made it all work. But it was an interesting start. We fell ass backwards into that, no mm-hmm. question. And you're the one that shoved us. So that's why you kind of had that reputation. So,
right.
But years later, we all made up, and we called you again on yes. a C300. So now we're back. Canon was producing a C300 original, the classic. Mm-hmm. And we looked for people to shoot demo films. Because mm-hmm. after Reverie, we figured that's the way you advertise a film. Mm-hmm. And you shot one of the first two or three, I forget which how many we did that time, with Polly Morgan, mm-hmm. who became one of my favorite cinematographers and people in the whole world. And thank that's you for cool. introducing me to her. She's fantastic, and she's going to be she's already enormous.
She's an Academy member, and is she ASC? Yes,
she's right. ASC, BSC, and Academy. It's been a big year for her.
So, I don't know how much more you can accomplish as an Oscar.
She's having another baby, too. So, and congratulations on your baby as well. So,
thank you.
COVID is a good time to have babies. So, you shot this film called Mobius, Polly shot this film
Polly
called
shooting.
Mobius. With Polly
yeah.
shooting it, yeah.
Yep.
And it sold a lot of C300s. This was mm-hmm. a big rollout. And the nerves were there. This was going to mm-hmm. be shown to, it was going to be introduced by Martin Scorsese in the big screen at Paramount. I know that in the audience was Ron Howard, everybody was there. Who else was in the audience? It was huge.
Rodriguez
definitely was, because I had to go invite him. They sent me down to Comic-Con to find him and give him an invite, and he was working on a taco truck because he was pushing out that Machete movie. They were giving away free tacos. I got in line, went up to the Machete truck and gave him my card and asked him if he'd come to our opening. So yeah, Rodriguez, I remember. Lots. I think William Shatner was there. Was a whole sort of.
It was a Paramount. I mean, it was a big deal.
It was huge. I think Wolfgang Puck catered it, and we rented studios for days. It was probably the biggest rollout of a product Hollywood had ever seen and has seen since. Nothing's ever topped it.
It was magical. It felt like that to me was the closest I came to like the Hollywood premiere of a film.
Yeah,
right?
It was huge. My feet didn't touch the ground for days after that. But we also put a lot of work into that.
Yeah.
I mean, I left my house on July 5th to work on these films. One of them was yours, but there was five for me because I had a different one to film. Came home September 16th.
Sorry.
And it included a trip to Japan it was just gone. I mean, my wife at one point said, just don't come home until it's over. I can't show up on Friday. Tell me to do laundry and leave on Monday. Just stay.
Right.
So I didn't come home. I didn't come home for months for this thing. When that thing rolled out, I've never felt so exhausted. And then, man, it hit the screen and it worked. It really worked.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I think that's what really changed a little bit for you. All of a sudden now the DGA is in sight. You're shifting gears at this point in your life from being not just but focusing on stills only to starting to tell motion stories.
Yeah,
and that's still a big part of your life right now, if not the biggest.
It is, and you know, the truth is, I think, you know, I regret my initial years in the film world, in that, you know, for those of you who ever get a chance to, meet people and get welcomed into Hollywood, you'll find that, you know, a lot of people are very receptive, whether it was you, Tim, whether it was Stephen Poster, whether it was, you know, Charles Papert, or, a lot of important, relatively, you know, influential people in the business who welcomed me with open arms. And I was like, why me? Because the problem for me wasn't my mistake, I think, in retrospect, if I had to do it over again, so this is the advice to people, is I had 15 plus years of photography experience, and I knew what it meant to be skilled at something, And I had 15 hours in video film. You know, I had a pedigree in film. I had an exposure to cinema. But at the end of the day, I don't think I really was, I knew I didn't really understand sequencing or coverage principles. You know, I knew the 180 rule, but that was about it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was being invited to speak to like the heads of Disney Studios about this camera. I had some incredible opportunities, but I put the brakes on myself and say, you know, I'm not ready. I don't want to come into this and screw it up or pretend that I know what I'm doing. And I think in retrospect, I probably should have bullshitted a little bit more because I found out how many people in Hollywood come in with no knowledge and make it.
Yeah.
But I personally put on the brakes because I'm not a person who ever likes to say, don't worry, I'll do it if I don't really believe that. I'll make it happen. I'll accomplish it. When I make that promise, I usually can back it up. So, you know, just a little feedback to people. If you ever get the door open like that for you and you know you're not ready, I mean, don't do something you're really, really, really not ready for. But, you know, the structure of the film business is such that you have a lot of experts you can work with that are technical people that can help you realize your vision. The problem for me is I'm such a technical person. I felt the need to know the technique myself and master it. And I really respect, you know, whether it's Scorsese or Kubrick or Spielberg, how they are, you know, students of film and of cinematic language and of structure. And I didn't want to do this until I had that well under control. And as you can imagine, that took quite a few years to do. So I went into commercials initially as a DP. I hated being screamed at by directors who themselves maybe didn't know what they were doing as much. I didn't like that part. And I did a few commercials where some directors really didn't know what they were doing and had me do everything. Mm-hmm. And I eventually said, well, if I'm going to do everything, I might as well, you know, jump off the bridge, you know, head first and direct. And that's where I, a few years later, went into directing, did mostly commercials, did a few short films, but I've been doing, you know, commercials for, God, it's been, I can't believe it's been 12 years now.
Yeah.
And working for a lot of clients, you know, a lot of stuff for Apple, for example, a lot of aerial stuff in general as a specialty. And it's been really exciting.
You know, commercials don't get their fair amount of attention.
No.
Commercials are, I watch commercials, the good ones. I mean, the really, really good ones. You've got to tell a story in 60 seconds, 30 seconds.
It's really challenging.
You've got a story arc that's 10 seconds and on one side and then a final act. And that's not, you know, I'm talking about certain commercials. You know, it's when they're done right, they're truly great pieces of art form. They're like movie trailers. You know, I mean, you've got to figure out what's going to grab somebody really quickly.
And you pull a team together in a very short period of time. Yep. It's like being a CEO or an entrepreneur and you find this talent you've either worked with before, or you find new talent and you interview them and you get together on the same page. I love the process. It's exhausting, but it's fascinating. I've loved being a commercial director quite a bit. I love being an aerial specialist more. You know, I've done other projects since, like Air and some other stuff, where I'm doing different things from the air that, you know, haven't necessarily been done before. And I really love the technical aspect of that too. So bouncing back and forth between that.
I saw Tenet. I think that's the only film I've actually seen this year, which is 2 hours and 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. I know not everybody did. I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I love Chris Nolan's work. I wonder if Chris Nolan's could tell a story in 30 seconds.
I'm sure he could, given it's Chris Nolan.
Yeah, maybe. But talk about a whole different channel. Doesn't translate.
It's not automatic translation. Just like your earlier example about Nakway and photographers. They don't all translate to video.
Yeah.
Or telling stories, even as opposed to single images. It's a different part of your brain. It's a different discipline.
Yeah.
You have to understand the craft, you know, and
what's happening to the commercial business now? I mean,
I don't think the trends are great. You know, I don't see the same level of creative that I used to see, you know, with the big agencies and the really smart people doing some really smart ads. They still happen, you know, like there was Spike Jones commercial a year or two ago that was amazing.
Right.
They still come out. Unfortunately, what's happening in the commercial world is that because of the economy, because of technology, we're being asked to do a lot more commercials with the same budgets.
Yeah.
So instead of doing one big campaign, like think about the Chanel campaign that runs for 3 to 5 years and they spend millions of dollars on it, but they get years out of it. Brands are now doing 5 spots at once, different types of cuts, and every 3 months. So it's a different experience because the budgets aren't necessarily increasing for that. And, it's definitely affected the business.
All right. We're coming up on the 50-minute mark. So I gotta get some words in from our sponsors and pay some bills. So
sure.
Just sit tight for a second. We'll be right back. This week's episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? Is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code Hollywood when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code Hollywood at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show. All right, we are back with Vincent LaFerre. Vincent is a gear nut, always has been, always has one of everything, and never has anything that's more than 2 weeks old. You also have the red Komodo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're the first person I know that I've seen one in the wild. I'm really impressed with this camera. I think Red has hit it out of the park. What are your impressions on this thing?
Well, I know that other people got it before me for sure, just to be clear.
Not that I knew.
Sure, fair enough. But, I think accuracy these days is important. Yeah. And I was probably the 20th person to get one. Jared put a lot of these things out. And I want to show you two things. This is my favorite camera possibly ever outside of a Leica. So that's a 500 series Hasselblad camera. And this is the Red Komodo. Now, let me pull back. The most important part is look at the size of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So forget the lenses, forget the batteries, forget the prism. The Komodo is actually smaller than a Hasselblad. If you take the lens and the batteries off. And you probably can't see it here, but this entire space here is empty. It's for fans. So the body actually comprises from here to back here and probably some stuff on the bottom and top. But it's mostly a void inside because of heat dissipation.
Right.
And what's interesting about this is that this is the first cinema body I've ever held in my hands. I held C300s, I held C200s, I held, all the Sony DSLRs, mirrorless, etc. This is the first camera in my life that I can take in a backpack with 2 batteries that run an hour and a half each. So I can just go on a trip with just 2 or 3 batteries, 1 lens, this is a Sigma 1835, right? And I can shoot a motion picture that is of the same quality almost as a Red or an Arri Alexa. Is it as good as an Arri Alexa or a Red Monstro? If you put it on charts, no. I'm sure you'll find clear advantages. But for the average person and the average consumer, I'm not sure you can tell the difference.
So it's a 6K, right?
It's a 6K camera, which is more than enough. Most cinemas are still 2K, very few are 4K.
Right.
More than anything, the color science in the sensor are phenomenal. That's it. It's the size, lack of weight, small size, very light, small battery consumption, which is key. By the way, people always forget that. But if you go out and you have to bring 10 V-Log batteries or Anton Bowers and a big charger with you, no go. I have what I call the backpack rule. Is it, can I put it in a backpack or a messenger bag and go on a weekend trip with a camera that determines whether or not I bring it for personal stuff or fun stuff versus a huge backpack or rolling cases? That's why I love my Leica so much. The image quality is incredible. It has the new RF mount, which means it can take almost any lens in the world, which is very smart of them to do. And it's fun. You turn it on, you shoot.
Is it natively an RF mount? Or is that a choice?
It's natively, so every Komodo has an RF mount on it. And there's the Canon adapter that either has an ND built in or not.
Right.
You can buy Kipretai adapters and stuff like that, and PL adapters. You can put every piece of glass, for the most part, on that, which you can't on a Canon mount or a PL mount. And it has the experience of shooting like this. And by the way, this is the digital one.
Yep. So
speaking of getting the new stuff, I love shooting this body either with 500 series camera, or this directly with a 907X, which is a little bit of an insert here with their new lenses. I haven't tried that yet, but it's very intriguing. And I'm now reverting towards these two cameras plus the Leica M10 in the back, and that's it for what I shoot for myself. Yes, I own a Monstro and a Helium, but that's in production. That stays at, you know, a partner of mine for rentals and stuff. These are the three cameras that I pull out for fun, and more than fun. I mean, I would pull this out on a job, but the key is I love the experience of the Komodo. I love the experience of a Hasselblad with those lenses and just the winding. Like every time you take a picture, that noise and the wind. Yeah. It's just,
I think that might be a little generational, but yeah.
I'm sure it is, but once you try it, you don't go back, because this camera forces you to slow down. You know, it's not a field camera, but it's a large sensor with optics that are sometimes hard to see exactly where the focus is. You put your head down, which is like a submissive thing to some degree when you're photographing or taking portraits. Mm-hmm. Someone to put your head down and not look directly at them. It's more respectful. You wind slowly. It's not what you hear in a White House press pool, where it's like da 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 da, like, you know, 20 frames a second, like crazy. There's no special thing about that, you know, whereas this,
yeah,
and then wind, it's something that hasn't changed for a very long time. These cameras literally went on to the moon, right, with Apollo. So, and then, you know, it's too far back there, but the Leica is the same thing, you know, small little body, click, wind, no winding now. I'm a big believer in the experience of photographing. I obviously use this thing, the iPhone,
yeah,
for the vast majority of things, like anyone else. But, you know, things are changing. And I think the Komodos are really good. I think if you look back, you know, the 5D Mark II was revolutionary and important in Canon's history. And the Komodo will have that place in there.
Yeah, I think so too. I think if I had to do a Hall of Fame, the 5D would be there. The Komodo is going to get there. What do you think of the new 12K Blackmagic?
I don't see it as necessary yet. It's an odd duck. I've always been a fan of Blackmagic for their software, Resolve. Mm-hmm. I love their sensors. The color tech they have is phenomenal. That's colors what they do. I've never been a particularly big fan of their ergonomics, especially not the pocket cameras, the huge screens. But they're extremely popular, especially with people who have smaller budgets. And then you can get phenomenal quality out of it on a sensor size. I just rather this form factor or others.
Yeah, I love the Komodo form factor.
I don't need 12K. We'll get to it. You know, other cameras will get there. It's like we're barely getting to the point where 8K workflows are smooth. So, you know, let's give ourselves a breather and allow 12K. But it's going to pick up. VFX are going to use that camera like crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they already are. I've been over to see Sam Nicholson at Stargate. He's got them all over the place. And it makes perfect sense for what he's got to do. And I was really impressed with the image. But then again, Sam can process all that stuff.
They gave me the first, I think it was the Cinema Pocket Camera or something.
Yeah. Oh, that Blackmagic Pocket
Camera. Looking camera. Yeah. It's a big reflective screen. And like, yeah. How am I supposed to shoot? I was in Sydney when I got it, actually, of all places. They shipped to me in California, and I flew to Sydney for another job, and here I am back in Australia, which is ironic, shooting the bridge there, the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I remember like not being able to see the image because the sun was in a certain spot where it was lighting me, yeah, and I was seeing a reflection. So, but even back then, that very, very first camera of theirs had phenomenal color and dynamic range, and they always will have. And the ergonomics of the Ursa is fantastic.
Yep.
It works great. It's just the pocket cameras and stuff I have a hard time with because I have PTSD from the 5D Mark II days. I like to put a camera on that I can shoot with right now without 20 accessories.
Oh, my God. The days that when we stepped away from having to rig those things. Let's jump back again. So Canon's coming out with an 8K, comes out with an 8K SLR.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm no longer with them. That is my alma mater.
Sure.
But I was... If I was still there, I'd have a little PTSD too, because back to the days of how to rig up and build out a camera, and all of a sudden it's 8K, and now all of a sudden I have to turn this little camera into a cinema camera. I'm not sure I know the point to this one now. I get the point to the 5D2, but I don't know. To me, that is right.
This again, I'm showing you that there's this much space. I'm holding my flashlight behind it.
All right, so this is a podcast, so let me say he's holding up the Komodo, which is incredibly small, and in his case, a pretty shade of blue. So.
And I'm showing Tim and the guys watching that a third of the camera is empty space. And what I'm trying to prove is that you can't fight physics at the end.
No, you cannot.
You know, there's a reason that this camera is the size it is versus the width of a R5 or whatever it is. And you can only dissipate so much heat so quickly in such in size. And that's what the problem with these new Canon cameras is they have these great aspirations, but unfortunately they're unfortunately unusable in a lot of circumstances where you're doing a sit-down interview for a length of time or shooting continually. If you're doing a quick shot here or there, no problem. But if you're trying to shoot for 10 or 15 minutes or more continually, it'll overheat and shut down. That's a big problem.
Right. And the bigger problem than the shutdown is the recovery time. You know, it's not that it shuts down in 15 minutes. It takes a long time. And that's what I'm reading. Like I said, I'm no longer with them, so I'm not really up on it. But, you know, I just wonder if from a standpoint of feature versus return, am I willing to put up with heat issues to get to get an 8K image? And I don't see it. Now, that said, the RF mount is spectacular. So it's all a matter of those things.
Sorry, it's post-COVID 2020 with the kids. Listen, you know, they have this new Franken camera they just released.
C7.
Which is one of the ugliest cameras I've probably ever seen. But I have a sneaking suspicion, as ugly as it is, it might be super functional with the dual AF chip and a lot of things they do. You know, Canon is just this weird company, I'm just going to say it, that has some incredible engineering and incredible talent. Yet, in terms of the product they release, you have a clear understanding that they're doing it in some sort of, you know, bubble away from reality in terms of like, hey, there's a reason an Alexa looks the way it does. There's a reason for our entire history of cinema that that form factor is there. And I respect your need to reinvent that. I respect that. It's important to question why it has this shape. But you should have some deference to why that shape exists, because it's probably based on our human form factor and the ergonomics of the camera working with that as opposed to fighting it.
Well, there's a reason a Nikon and a Sony SLR look the same. There's a reason for how that fits into our hands.
Exactly.
They never really, really try to redesign that because they understand it. But on the motion standpoint, motion side, you know, we started with a motion camera that looked like an SLR. And then just kept morphing. And the C70 is a pretty funky looking camera.
They do these weird things, like they have that knob where you can hook up the tape to measure. You know, I have never in 12 years seen a crew member use a knob in any of those cameras to literally use a piece of tape to measure anything. Yes, I've seen you use tape. Yes, I've seen you use, you know, Cinetape and other things. But I've never said, oh, that is a key feature I need to put on my camera, a knob where you can hook up the tape to measure focal distance. It's insane. And you're like, who are you talking to?
Me.
That's telling you?
I did that all the time. But that was only to calibrate glass. It wasn't in a real environment. It was when I was in my labs and somebody said, this is not, these are off. And I was a one-man band trying to work it out. So
there's nothing wrong with having it. It was what I'm trying to say.
I could have done it a different way.
No, just that someone at Canon thinks that's a more important feature than, let's say, you know, back in the day, an XLR input, which every camera needs. Right.
Well, the one feature on the 70 that throws me, and I'm not there to ask, but it has an SDI Genlock port, but no HD SDI video port, only HDMI.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer for
you. We hate HDMI. Everybody does.
No one since the beginning has ever wanted to use it, because how many HDMI cables did we tear out of a 5D Mark II?
All of them.
Subsequent camera, all of them.
Yeah.
How many suits were killed because you had a loose HDMI connector and your drone went up or it's in something else,
but,
and you can't access it to wiggle it around and you have no image.
If you're going to, and you can put Genlock on an SDI, they can live on the same port.
Yeah.
They do live on the same port. That one threw me. It's like, you know, man, it's just too many times in the real world has this been a problem. Now, that said, it's at the right price point. It's got a hell of a sensor. It's got good color science.
You know, if I were a one-person band,
it's gonna kill in the dock world, which they already kill in. It's gonna kill in the one-man band situation. It's probably got great latitude. I haven't tested it. It's probably a very good camera at a very good price point. But there'll be certain brick walls that it's not gonna get over.
Right.
So, because of silly things. So,
if only they listened a little bit more. or brought people in earlier. That was always been my criticism of Canon. It's by the time I was being shown, and don't get me wrong, I know you listened very well. I know that, you know, we were asked early on a lot of times when I was an explorer. I just feel that back in Japan, they may not have been listening as well as they could have. True. Because all too well, and more important, the timing, they would show us these finished prototypes that were far too far along to change anything on at that point.
Yeah, by the time they asked you, it was a done deal.
Yeah. And I big mistake those companies make.
I always said, like, when people would, it would be my job to give my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I had to always make them understand that I didn't have an opinion. I have everybody else's opinion.
Yep.
I was the one that spent a day talking to Vincent or talking to Stephen yep. Poster. I have all yep. of their opinions, not my opinions. Yep. I work for a company. I'm not a filmmaker. I yep. will tell you what the customers tell us and try to absorb it and put it out in a such way. But no, I never had an opinion. I had your opinion. And I just shared it with them. And occasionally they would take it. Depends on how soon you got in.
Right.
The original C300, they took it all.
Right.
That was the best development period cycle ever, because mm-hmm. They just sort of admitted that the 5D was out of their wheelhouse and they needed to go to this next level, and it was selling so well in the U.S. Let's let the U.S. tell us what to do. And they did it. And they listened to you, and they listened to me, and they listened to Joe Bogaz in product group, and they did those things. There were ports and time code issues on that camera when we were shooting with the prototypes.
Yeah.
And we said, this is not acceptable. And they delayed it and fixed it.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was full speed ahead. Yeah. So, and I don't know if every company's like that or not. That's what I like about Red. I don't think they are. I think they have some very strong people at the top.
Yes.
Who are strong enough to say, yeah, we're not doing it today. Not now. Right. That's not gonna fly. We gotta do this right or don't do it. So.
Yeah, I mean, Red learned a lot from releasing stuff too early, you know, and their reputation was initially tarnished by just releasing beta stuff and people on big commercials, film sets, big commercial productions, big movies were like, I can't have a camera crashing or having an issue.
Or an overheating issue. But Red's coming with
his own. Jared and Jim learned that, and they changed it to where now they're very open about, hey, if you want a Komodo today, it's beta. No production-ready ones yet. And for 2 to 3 to 4 months, they work out the bugs with, you know, 100 shooters that mm-hmm. buy the initial betas. And by the time it comes out, you know, Jared will tell you that it is so far ahead of where they would have been otherwise and so much more stable that it's a smart way of doing it. You know what? And the truth is, we've all learned how to make this better and do all this over time.
Yeah.
It's been, you know, a decade or two, and you realize that it's an evolution, and we learn, and it's part of the program, and it's a privilege to be part of it.
Yeah, it's been pretty exciting. It's truly been a great run. So, all right. So I think I'm sort of running out of time here.
Okay.
So, but I really appreciate this. We could talk forever, and maybe we will at some point again. Congratulations on the baby. Stay
thank
home,
you.
Stay healthy, stay safe, all that kind of stuff. And thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure, Tim. Cheers.
Cheers. Well, that brings us to the end of episode 10. I'd like to take a minute to offer special thanks to our producers, Avery and Joe, and the Pro Video Coalition Network for sticking with us, and to Adrian for keeping up with all our social media. Starting a podcast in the middle of COVID presents some unique challenges, and I truly appreciate all the support. I'd also like to thank Vincent for taking time out of his busy schedule to come on today and talk with us, and of course you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's show and will visit our archive of shows from earlier in the season. Be sure to click subscribe so that you never miss an episode. The industry is coming back in baby steps, but it is coming back. Once we get all this behind us, I believe it will roar back to life to fill the backlog of demand waiting for our audiences. Till then, take care of yourself, and we'll see you next time on Hollywood, How Did You Get Here?